This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, and today our show is going to look at education from the perspective of somebody who's been talking about it quite a while now and learning about it as well. The host of the Cutting Ed podcast is John Harris's guest on this week's Prairie Pulse television show. Tom Gerhardt is the Director of Public Affairs for North Dakota United, and in this excerpt, he talks about what he's learned as he's traveled the state to learn more about innovative education in North Dakota.
Tom, thanks for joining us today.
It's great to be here, John.
What is North Dakota United?
North Dakota United is the union for K-12 teachers, for higher education, and public employees. We have about 11,500 members statewide. We have members in every county in North Dakota. It could be someone who runs the snowplow for the county. It could be someone that works for the tax department. Anybody that's a public employee, we're going to advocate for them at the Capitol during the legislative session year-round, obviously, really, and communicate their stories and tell the story of the great job that they do, you know, public service. Where would we be without it?
Let's talk about your education podcast that you have. What is that?
Yeah, that's another one of those duties as assigned. So last fall, sort of out of the blue, Ted Dintersmith, who we'll talk a little bit more about, he's a real advocate for reimagining education all across the United States. And he had been to all 49 states, but had not been to North Dakota as of 2015. And he came and actually spoke here in Fargo at a TEDx talk and found that the collaboration all the way from the governor's office to the North Dakota Department of Public Instruction to North Dakota United and others, the collaborative nature of all of them was so great that he has since spent quite a bit of time here. So this last fall in 2017, he came and pitched the idea of starting a podcast essentially about reimagining education in North Dakota. So I would say in September, this idea was pitched, and about a month later, we had a podcast recorded and on the air, so to speak. So it was a very quick transition, but it tells the story of education in North Dakota, but more importantly, how that vision is changing.
Hmm. Well, explain a little bit more. Ted Dintersmith, can you talk a little bit more about him?
Yeah, so Ted was a venture capitalist that worked out of the Boston area, Cambridge, Massachusetts. So he worked with a lot of folks that were innovating business-wise from startups across the country. And from that, he said he gained this vision of innovation that transferred to education. He started to see how technology and education were intersecting. So his main concern is training young people, teaching young people now for jobs that we simply don't know what they will be, what the future holds. And so reimagining education, I guess, is kind of a way that he looks at it. So he's been very involved in education. He is executive producer of a documentary that several people may have seen. It's been shown here in Fargo and throughout the state, throughout the nation for that matter, called Most Likely to Succeed. And it tells the story of a class in San Diego at High Tech High and how the students in that class, in that school, are transformed throughout a school year. And it's not a typical education that they're receiving. They're not sitting in rows in desks with 50-minute class periods. It's kind of a real wide-open learning experience.
Yeah. How did the passage of Senate Bill 2186 help with this?
Well, so Senate Bill 2186 was supported broadly in a bipartisan manner in the last session. And essentially what the bill does is sort of relaxes some of the red tape, you might say, restrictions that were preventing a little bit maybe from the classroom teacher or a school district to doing maybe the things that they wanted to try. And sort of this sort of innovative idea. So it's kind of referred to as the Innovative Education Bill. And it gives a lot of power back to the local school districts, which we think is really important. It's sort of opened doors, I think, for teachers and learners to do and try new things in the classroom.
How long is a typical podcast?
The idea initially was to make them about 15 minutes long. So the thought was, whether you're in a rural area or in a metro area in North Dakota, that by the time you commute to work and home, you'd be able to listen to a podcast. I have found it difficult, I'll say, mm-hmm. to hit that 15-minute mark. So none of them have gone longer than a half hour, but a lot of them have been in the 20-minute range, but pretty easily digestible in the drive to work and the drive home.
Well, in public radio, we talk about driveway moments, so I guess you're hoping some people will sit in the driveway or in the parking lot listening to the rest of it. But what have you learned so far as you've done this?
I've learned so much, and I'm certainly no expert. The teachers, the folks that are there on the ground every day deserve all the credit, and the students that are doing the learning. But I see myself as a conduit between the public and what's actually happening in education. And before the legislative session and before the start of this podcast, I really had no idea of the innovative things that have been happening for years, by the way. This isn't something that just started with the passage of the bill. But the things that teachers are doing every day in classrooms is simply amazing.
Okay. Well, maybe try to get into a little more specifics. Some schools across the state are really sort of taking the lead and changing the way they're delivering education. Can you talk about what they're doing?
Yeah, I was in Oaks, North Dakota, for instance, and they've implemented something that's called flexible modular scheduling. Again, we're accustomed to the 50-minute class periods, maybe 7 class periods a day. The bell rings, you go on, everyone's learning the same history lesson, everyone's learning the same algebra lesson. We're in a flex mod schedule. They break these mods up into 20-minute segments. And so again, if I need more time with algebra, I can spend more time there. If you need less time with algebra, you can spend less time there, move on to more difficult lessons. Perhaps you could get an internship in town where you have hands-on learning. There's project-based learning where there's a project that people collaborate on, and those are the types of skills that Ted Dintersmith and others feel are essential for the future, for the jobs of the future.
Mm-hmm. So where can we find these podcasts, and when are they made available?
Each Tuesday, we release a new podcast available everywhere you can find your podcast. So one place that it will always be easy to find is at our website, ndunited.org. But it's also on iTunes, Google Play. You can find it on Spreaker, SoundCloud, places that I hadn't heard of 6 months ago.
So they may not have been around 6 months ago either.
It's widely available.
Okay. With that, what's been the reaction so far to this?
There's been a lot of positive reaction, and the part that I enjoy the most is really getting out into these schools and these communities and visiting with the teachers, hearing students that are excited about these new learning experiences, talking to administration and how they're working with residents in their communities, with school boards to get buy-in to try new things. And so that's been extraordinarily interesting and energizing to see how North Dakota really is taking the lead in reimagining education, teaching our students for the future that, again, is really unknown at this point.
Yeah. Where do you see education going in the next 5 to 10 years? I know you got a crystal ball somewhere.
I do.
And, yeah. More research like this, or what are you seeing?
Yeah,
what
are you, that Senate Bill 2186 we talked about really opened the door. And so, plans need to be submitted from school districts to the Department of Public Instruction to be okayed. But, Senator Nicole Pullman said that she just hopes it relaxes restrictions and gives classroom teachers more, ability, flexibility to do what it is they want to do with their own students. I mean, who knows a classroom better than the teacher, and who knows the students better than the teacher that's with them? I would say 5 years from now, I know the hope of some of these leaders in schools like Northern Cass and Oaks and Legacy and Garrison, they really hope that education is transformed and we're not doing the things we've been essentially doing for the past century.
Mm-hmm. How important is it to train students ahead of time so that they have the right skills for the workforce and maybe they choose the right college or path that suits them?
Well, and I think that's the thing. Is college the right decision for everyone? There's technical school, there's the military. That's a great question, and that's one really interesting thing that I found. North Dakota students don't have any trouble getting into college. Where the trouble exists is once they graduate, they often don't know what they want to do. and they have a large amount of debt. I think we're at $1.4, $1.5 trillion in student loan debt nationwide, significant issue. So again, going back to these new models of education, if you can find a passion area, something that you're passionate about as a student with that flexibility in your schedule, you can find things that you're passionate about, try things out, maybe get that internship or two where you find out, I really love this, I don't really like this. And the hope is that by the time you're out of college now, you know what it is you want to do, or at least have a better idea.
Yeah, Tom, sorry, we're out of time. So if people want more information, where can they go?
ndunited.org.
Okay. Tom, thanks for joining us today.
Pleasure to be here.
That's Tom Gerhart, Director of Public Affairs for North Dakota United, visiting with Prairie Pulse host John Harris. You can watch the full show tonight at 7:30 Central on the television service of Prairie Public. Next on Main Street, a Plainsfolk essay from historian Tom Ezern.
Programming on Prairie Public is supported by Basin Electric Power Cooperative of Bismarck, a Touchstone Energy Cooperative, producing reliable electricity for 138 member rural electric systems in 9 states.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Tom Ezern is a Main Street regular. Every week we share his Plainsfolk essay, written and voiced from his perspective as a distinguished professor of history and someone who deeply appreciates a good story. Today his piece is titled, A Chance to Express Themselves.
The great Alfred G. Arvold, founder of the Little Country Theater at North Dakota Agricultural College, was a heck of a storyteller. His classic work on his life's work, The Little Country Theater, published in 1923, begins with a scene that is about a scene. Two young Icelandic immigrants named Thorfinnsson and Brim arrive in Arvold's office at the college. They've come in for counsel. They want to produce a play they are writing, a play entitled The Raindrops, a metaphorical drama about love, separation, sacrifice, and humanity. Not exactly what you might expect from a couple of farm boys. The playwrights have a problem. The drama is set in the old country, and no one possesses a painted backdrop depicting a quaint cottage in a mountain valley in Iceland. Arvold told them they should paint the scene themselves. They were skeptical, but they did it. And when the play was presented, writes Arvold, the audience sat spellbound, evidently realizing that two country lads had found hidden life forces in themselves, which they never knew they possessed. All they needed was just a chance to express themselves. Alfred Arvold was North Dakota's foremost exponent of the country life movement and inspired an organized effort to enrich life in rural America so that farm boys and girls would stay on the farm, sustain communities, and live well. Because he was a theater guy, Arvold thought community theater should be the center of community life, but this was in the context of his vision for contentment in the countryside. Arvold delighted in going into communities and galvanizing theatrical enterprises. He also established the Little Country Theater on the upper floor of Old Main at NDAC as a laboratory so that graduates would go forth and do likewise in their own communities. Perhaps most of all, he praised, validated, and promoted the work of organizers across the state. Across the northern prairies today, there are stirrings in the pot of community theater. I am familiar with the actors in that hive of the arts, the Ellendale Opera House, but I know of similar activity in Lisbon, Ashley, New Rockford, and countless other towns across North Dakota. There is today, however, no Alfred Arvold to stand as the prophet and inspiration for these local enterprises. The field is open for someone to fill Arvold's shoes, to pull together the local partisans of theater laboring where they are, to provide support, technical and artistic, for their efforts, and to start a conversation about what community theater might say and do in prairie communities of the 21st century, a century after Arvold. I have long thought we should be stimulating, supporting, and rewarding playwrights who can provide us with new works that speak to prairie people where they are. I now turn the story back over to Arvold as he receives another aspiring playwright, this one from Edmonds, North Dakota. Arvold talks with him about his life on the farm and the theme for his play. The conversation turns to the decision whether to stay on the farm or move to the city. "Good," says Arvold. "There's the theme for your play, country life versus city life." The play, A Bee in a Drone's Hive, was staged to great acclaim. Further, as to its author, Arvold recounts, "Today he operates nearly 400 acres of land. He has 40 head of cattle, 8 of which are registered shorthorns. He is a successful farmer in every respect. During his spare moments, he takes part in home talent plays. He loves the drama. He's married, and he has a family."
That's Tom Ezern. Coming up on Main Street, a discussion about the myriad changes that affect women as they prepare for motherhood.
The plight of missing and murdered Indigenous women too often goes unnoticed.
Native people deserve the same support and attention that every other demographic gets.
I'm independent producer Meg Luther Lindholm, inviting you to join me for this week's Prairie Public Presents. The program is Testimonies, which brings people with similar life experiences and challenges together to talk about them.
I get out there and I couldn't believe there's no help. There's no one. There's a half a dozen people. And I thought, that's all she's worth?
On Testimonies, Sunday at 5 p.m. Central, 4 Mountain on Prairie Public.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Recently, the public radio show The Takeaway looked at a subject that many people often overlook, especially if they're men. Host Duarte Geraldino talked with reproductive psychiatrist Dr. Alexandra Sachs. Dr. Sachs is calling for women and doctors to talk more often and openly about the many changes that happen to women when they are experiencing matrescence, the interval between conception and delivery.
How come we only have words for things like postpartum depression? What about the normal transition? Just like teenagers who go through adolescence, women go through matrescence. And I believe that if we can educate women more about what are the pillars of matrescence and get women talking to each other more, we could maybe even change the way postpartum depression is experienced and talked about in our culture.
We've been bringing you conversations about the healthcare challenges unique to women. And last week, many of you called to tell us that we need better overall postpartum care in America. Dr. Sachs says yes, and understanding this transitional period is one step.
You know, what I've really learned is that it's not just psychiatric. Women don't return for a health visit with their OBGYN until 6 weeks.
6 weeks later.
6 weeks later, right. So when we say, is the postpartum under examined, I would say yes, and that's physical and emotional. In countries like England, the government pays for a nurse to come visit a woman immediately after the postpartum, certainly within that six-week window, because we know that's the most common time for things to come up in terms of complications, physical and emotional, that are the result of the labor and delivery experience and the enormous physiological and anatomical change that happens during pregnancy.
So often when we think about these changes, we only talk about postpartum depression. But if you could expand my horizons a little bit more and explain to me about some of the other changes that take place during this period.
The body is going through an amazing shift, and there are all these interesting consequences. There hasn't, unfortunately, been enough research, and that's part of what I'm trying to sort of call out. But in the 2017 Nature Neuroscience, there was a wonderful article that was published based on research that was done by scientists in Spain and the Netherlands, where they showed that there are brain changes that we can see in women up to 2 years after delivering a baby. The interpersonal regions actually changed. So those might be regions actually that code for the ability to empathize, to maybe recognize your baby's cry or zoom into their facial cues. So these are interesting questions. How have women even been evolutionarily impacted in terms of brain changes for what to zero in on in terms of the experience of caretaking and zooming in on those interpersonal strengths? And, you know, it's really fascinating. The human baby is really the most vulnerable in all of the animal kingdom, potentially. We know that to be as independent as a baby chimpanzee, a human baby would have to be 18 months old. So women would have to be pregnant for 18 months to be on par with what chimpanzees have in terms of their mother-child care. So it's a really phenomenal relationship between the mother and the baby in terms of this tremendous dependency in the first year of life.
If there are two or three points that you want women to know about matrescence, what would those be?
So one of them is that I would say you're going to be experiencing the emotion of ambivalence.
Ambivalence?
Yes. And ambivalence does not mean that you're ambivalent about how much you love your baby, but you're going to feel ambivalent about the push and pull required for having to take care of your baby constantly and how to navigate figuring out how to take care of yourself. You're going to feel guilty when you have moments where you need to let your baby cry for a minute so that you can actually go to the bathroom or so that you can pick up the telephone. We are humans. We're not robots, and we can't cut off our needs. But when we're put in the position of having to care for this vulnerable creature, it's a feeling of ambivalence that we have when we have to pull away from them to care for ourselves. But it's really that push and pull of leaning in, loving our children, and then stepping back and saying, okay, who am I? What do I need to do for my emotional wellness, my intellectual wellness, my relationships with my friends and partner, my professional identity and goals? How do I lean in and lean out to care for my child and myself in this dance?
So what would it take to change the silence around some of these issues?
I think there's so much stigma and shame around the ups and downs that happen for women, that women aren't speaking as openly as they could, which would, I think, really prevent a lot of the isolation and shame that may fuel rates of depression. I hear from women in my office that they come in and they say, I'm the only one in my group of friends who's had a miscarriage. I'm the only one who has not been able to breastfeed. And statistically, that is just simply not accurate. The rates of those experiences are so much higher than I think many women admit to each other socially. But I think we really have polarized the concepts of a perfect mother and bad mother. And so I think women often don't talk about their matrescence stories because really the experience of motherhood is a lot of ups and downs. There's so many things that are normal, transitional, that sort of get easier after the first year that we really need to educate people about so they can speak more openly and feel more reassured.
So I think some people might hear this and say, okay, all this is well and good to talk about these issues more, but how do we get more funding for actual programs to help women? Is there a way to get insurance providers, hospitals, medical professionals to take notice of this and relieve some of the financial burden of this period in a woman's transition to motherhood?
In general, we need to have more funding for preventative care. And we also need to give doctors more reimbursement for spending time talking to their patients. You know, dosing a medication or doing a procedure can be coded differently and often more highly reimbursed than the time spent talking with our patients. So we really need to shift that model and encourage insurance companies to reimburse doctors for more time spent educating patients about preventative approaches. I also think we need to talk to doctors more about remembering to pay attention to the woman, even in pediatric encounters when we're there to talk about the child, to ask mom, how are you doing? But there still isn't enough service for treatment. We need to have more access to care for psychotherapy and for mental health treatment options that, you know, really need to be viewed as important and as impactful for health as physical conditions.
Dr. Alexandra Sachs, reproductive psychiatrist, New York Times contributor, co-author of the forthcoming book, How Come No One Told Me, The Emotional Guide to Pregnancy and the First Year of Motherhood. Thank you.
Thank you.
That was Duarte Garaldino, host of The Takeaway. Coming up on Main Street, our Friday chat about the week's headlines with our news director, Dave Thompson. And Madeline reviews the latest movie about the Kennedy family, Chappaquiddick. Now the news with Danielle.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. The University of Mary is launching a new program designed to give teachers a chance to become school administrators. The School Leadership Institute will allow teachers to get their master's degrees in administration over 3 years. Those enrolled in the program will take online courses during the school year and will spend a 2-week summer residency at UMary. Rod Jonas is the dean of the Liffrig Family School of Education at UMary. He says it follows the existing program at the school.
And we've noticed a lot of the students coming in are actually teachers who have been asked either by their local administrator or someone else within their school to pursue a school administrator's degree because they're going to have retirements in their school district. So that's what we noticed. Many of them are from rural North Dakota schools. So we thought, how could we help bring many of these teachers to a school administration position by offering them a master's degree in a more timely, probably more convenient fashion?
Jonas says scholarships are available based on need. The program launches this summer, and the deadline to apply is June 1st. To mark National Crime Victims Rights this week, North Dakota U.S. Attorney Christopher Myers handed out a number of victim assistance awards. It's the second time he's done that.
Far too often, the stuff that happens behind the scenes, working with victims, helping them, rarely gets recognized. And it's probably one of the most important things we do on a daily basis.
One of the awards went to a Fargo woman who is the founder of Hope and Healing at the Plains Art Museum. Nikki Anderson is a trained therapeutic arts facilitator. She focused on the opioid epidemic. Anderson and her husband lost a son to an overdose of fentanyl-laced heroin. Anderson received the Special Courage Victim Assistance Award.
I just want to say, despite all the darkness that we've had and all of you see on a daily basis, we still believe in beauty. We still believe in goodness. And we believe and are grateful for all the goodness that we see every day, and that includes all of you here.
The theme of the ceremony was Expand the Circle, Reach All Victims. And UND's student government elections took a little longer than planned on Wednesday because of technical issues with the online voting system. Voting was suspended for a few hours in the morning. Those voting early were asked to re-vote after the system was reset. UND Associate Dean of Students Cassie Gerhardt says the voting deadline was extended 2 hours.
In the initial plan, polls would have been open 8 to 8. Given the glitch, we were open 11:30 a.m. until 10 p.m. Given what we were dealing with, it was the fairest process that we could apply.
Eric Hansen and Caleb DeShock were elected as president and vice president by 25 votes over Teresa Hanley and Abby Morlock. Hansen is currently student body vice president. Results are not official until confirmed by the Student Senate in early May. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
Well, by the old teletype machine in the background, it's time to talk with our news hound, Dave Thompson, who's by our microphone in Bismarck. Our news director is a regular element of Main Street on Fridays. Dave, always a pleasure to talk with you.
Oh, thank you, Doug. Pleasure to talk with you, too.
Trade has been much in the news, much speculated about, much concern about it in North Dakota, which is a major trading partner with China and lots of other countries. Apparently, some encouraging news. Our governor was in Washington to talk with the president about this.
Right. And, very soon after that meeting, which apparently there were members of Congress involved, too, but Governor Bergen was out there, that leaked out that he is talking now, the president, about getting back into a Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement, which could really be good for North Dakota ag products. But, of course, they would like to renegotiate it. And in terms of NAFTA, almost everybody in the Dakotas and Minnesota in farm country is saying, please, let's keep NAFTA. And, maybe renegotiate it, maybe modernize it, that's fine, but don't throw it out.
Well, I talked to Simon Wilson. He's the brand new executive director of the North Dakota Trade Office.
Right.
And he was expressing some concern about that and optimism that cooler heads would prevail.
You talk about the soybean situation. You don't realize how important soybeans are to the Asian markets, especially China. So if we do have some tariff wars going on or whatever you want to call them with China, they are worried they're going to lose market share.
Well, this Trans-Pacific Partnership is definitely one of the game pieces in the business with China.
Yeah,
because
absolutely.
This would create sort of an end around China. And it was interesting that the president used the TPP basically as a campaign issue. He was very much against it and canceled it like 3 days after he came into office. But now he can see the utility apparently.
Yes, he can. And although he did talk about renegotiating it.
Yeah.
So that, there's that the thing could be negotiation strategy. The chess game, which pieces go where.
And, of course, our congressman, who's been aligning himself pretty closely to the president, is also saying, let's cool the hysteria over Chinese tariffs. You reported on that early this week.
I did. That was one of the interviews that I got from him at the Republican convention as he was getting ready to be nominated for the U.S. Senate. And he said this came out because of all the concern about the soybeans and perhaps corn and wheat, that he said, you know, maybe it's time to just cool the hysteria down a little bit and let's take a look at the end game. Is what he was saying. So.
Well, speaking of the GOP convention last weekend, you covered it. You were there. Sometimes things can turn on a dime.
They certainly can.
We have a congressional candidate who's dropped out on the GOP side.
Right. And this has been an interesting journey for Senator Tom Campbell. He was first out of the gate to say he was going to run for the U.S. Senate. Then Kevin Cramer, who our congressman, who had been reluctant to do so, threw his hat in the ring. And then Campbell said, okay, I will run for the U.S. House. Kelly Armstrong from Dickinson came in. He won the nomination. And at first, Senator Campbell was going to go to the primary, but in the matter of about 48 hours, he was convinced to basically step out of the way and let Kelly Armstrong take that. There is just one small caveat, because in North Dakota law, he cannot remove his name from the ballot because he's filed the petitions to be on the ballot in the primary. So his name will continue to appear on the ballot in the primary, although he has given up any kind of campaigning for it.
It's going to be a little crowded on the Republican side because Tiffany Abendroth and Paul Schaffner are also on that ballot, aren't they?
They sure are. And there were a couple of people who were talking about perhaps being on the ballot too, but their names did not surface.
All right. In the meantime, former State Senator Max Schneider, who has the Democrat endorsement, will be the person on that side of the ballot, I take. Is there somebody opposing him too?
And there's nobody opposing him that I could see, and I looked at the Secretary of State's website to see who has filed for different primary seats. I think this is going to be very interesting, maybe more of a sleeper race than people might think.
I would agree.
Only because we have an open House seat. That hasn't happened for a while.
And we've got a Republican Party nationally that's facing some real resistance. So this is going to be an interesting year for
it certainly is.
These elections, these midterm elections, which are sometimes bellwethers of where people's feelings are, if you will.
Absolutely. And you see already the ramp up of the campaigns in the U.S. Senate race already. And we haven't even gotten to the primary yet.
I saw a full-page ad in the Fargo Forum this week that was put in by some PAC for Heidi. They weren't saying that necessarily, but against Kevin Cramer.
Mm-hmm,
So the money's being spent.
It sure is.
Let's talk about something that's very important to our edge of the state, if you will. And you reported this just a few hours ago, that you've heard some favorable scuttlebutt about that diversion plan we're all interested in here.
This was interesting to me because I went to the Water Commission because the Fargo-Moorhead Diversion Authority was seeking the next payment, $66,500,000 from the Water Commission, you know, part of the state share of the project. First off, Mayor Tim Mahoney said we're going to delay that until June, and there's going to be a meeting in Fargo of the Water Commission in June. And then the county commissioner came up and said he's been hearing from his sources – that there's a lot of support for the new Plan B that was basically developed through that task force that Governor Burgum and Governor Dayton had. That's the most positive thing I've heard for a while. But again, we still have an injunction in place. There's still some court things to go through, and there's still the DNR. Is the DNR going to sign a water permit for this?
And that decision is still pending. It's very important. But the scuttlebutt from Cass County Commissioner Chad Peterson is that he's hearing some favorable vibes.
Yes, and he said if the DNR did not sign it, he would be shocked.
Mm-hmm. Meanwhile, the price tag keeps going up. Fargo Mayor Tim Mahoney in your story says the new estimate is $2.2 billion.
And that was explained at the Water Commission, and I wanted to hear what the explanation was. It's very interesting because they've reduced upstream impacts. They haven't reduced them entirely, but they've lessened them, and now there's more impact in Cass County. And according to the people on the Diversion Authority, that has driven the cost up. Plus, the more you delay in getting it built, the more the cost goes up as well.
Well, let's talk about a very troubling story. This has been reported by the Forum. Kim Hyatt had a story very early this week, or last week, I should say, a report alleging ongoing rape game among male students at the Richland 44 School District. We've had lots of resignations, people departing the district, the superintendent and others who are paying the price, I guess, mm-hmm. for this. Very troubling story.
It is. Five students have been charged, and they actually face some felony charges. When this whole story broke, it really was odd to me when reading some of the stuff about it. And I don't know if we still know the full story of what all happened.
We do know that people in that district are very distressed, and it's created some relationship issues.
As you might expect. And, you know, Colfax is not a huge town like Fargo. So there's a lot of, you know, people know everybody. You know your neighbor, and you probably know your neighbor's kids. So I understand where that could be in a fairly small, close-knit community, where this could be one of those things that kind of rips things apart for a while.
And this, so-called rape game was an incidence of hazing that had been going on apparently for quite a long time, years even. You had a story not so long ago, about earlier today maybe, or late yesterday, the former Burleigh County deputy arrested for possession of meth and stolen cell phones, and we're not talking about a little bit here.
We're talking about 13 cell phones. We're talking about drug paraphernalia, and we're talking about a pound of meth,
wow.
which has a street value of more than $10,000. Now, the allegation is that this deputy was a part of the Metro Area Narcotics Task Force, and he worked for the Narcotics Task Force until December 2017 and was reassigned. And they believe that what may have happened is he got into an evidence locker or somehow got a hold of evidence and took it home. And that's where they found it. He was working on a Saturday. He asked for an extra hour for some personal time. When he didn't show up for 3 hours, his supervisor, a sergeant, went to his home, and that's where they found some of the paraphernalia.
Yeah.
Evidence
of a crime in your story.
That is correct. And now he faces charges. He's in the Stutzman County Jail in Jamestown. And you can understand because, you know, the Burleigh County people have been working with him, and the jailers wanted to avoid any conflict of interest. That's why the state's attorney has farmed it out to McLean County as well.
Let's talk about this story you had about five natural gas processing projects in the Bakken. Boy, that's getting to be boom time.
It is, and you're talking about a couple things are happening. Natural gas production continues to go up, and by the fourth quarter of 2018, the whole industry is facing a new standard. You have to capture 88% of the gas. That means no more than 12% flaring. So there's some work to get these plants put together and up and running and get the infrastructure in place and get more lines to capture the gas from wells and get them to these plants. Now, I happened to attend the Director's Cut webinar, and one of the things that they talk about is the flaring situation. And right now, what is being flared would be about 2.5 natural gas plants.
Wow.
Now, if this keeps going up, that's why they need five. And sometime in the future, there's going to be more than that that's going to be needed because gas will keep going up for a while.
Well, you say this is $1 billion in economic development, according to Commissioner Brian Crocius. And one more very interesting wrinkle about energy, Dave, you had this story. Using electricity to produce ammonia, this is research stuff that might be real.
It is real, and you have a number of oil companies. You've got the state, you've got the Federal Department of Energy all looking at this, and the EERC at UND is the one who's actually looked at it, and other countries are doing the same thing. They're looking at it. For example, Korea may be really serious about, you know, finding a way to use ammonia as an energy source, basically because it's no carbon in it. Nitrogen and hydrogen is all you've got. And then if you use it for fuel, what are the byproducts? Nitrogen. More than 80% of our atmosphere is nitrogen and water. And the carbon dioxide is not in the picture. And the research is showing, too, that if you add ammonia to like lignite coal or subituminous coal, things like that, it will help capture some of that CO2, too, and reduce that carbon footprint.
No, The 21st century is getting real exciting.
It is. This is going to be one to watch, I think.
Always a pleasure to talk with you, Dave.
Nice to talk to you.
Coming up next, Matt Olien reviews Chappaquiddick.
The State Historical Society of North Dakota, as part of their Sensational Sunday series, presents the Good Government Summit, a timely discussion about ethics in government and how North Dakota citizens rate theirs. Sunday, April 15th from 1 to 4 p.m. at the North Dakota Heritage Center in Bismarck. Humanities scholar and host of the Thomas Jefferson Hour, Clay Jenkinson, will portray the third president live and in costume. Merrill Pepcorn will read a Dakota Datebook. And Main Street's Doug Hamilton will moderate a distinguished media panel that includes Prairie Public's news director Dave Thompson, along with Amy Dalrymple of the Bismarck Tribune, the Grand Forks Herald's Mike Jacobs, Cecile Warman of Journal Publishing, and Forum Communications' Jack Zaleski. The event is free and open to the public. More information at history.nd.gov/events. The Good Government Summit, Sunday, April 15th, 1 to 4 p.m. in Bismarck.
There's the fanfare. The movie is playing. It's current. It's a bit of history. And Matt Olien, you took in this bit of history recently.
Yeah, director John Curran's Chappaquiddick. The big question I have about this film, which is about the driving accident involving Ted Kennedy and Mary Jo Kopechne in July of 1969 at Chappaquiddick. They were, you know, on vacation. There was a sailing race that day. And she was there because it was sort of a reception to honor Robert Kennedy's boiler room girls who helped with his campaign in 68. Kopechne was one of those workers in his campaign. A lot of still unanswered questions to this day about what really happened. My question going in is, why does a film like this need to be made right now? I was kind of baffled when I saw it was coming out. My first instinct when I saw a film was coming out was, is this a hit job on Ted Kennedy? Because sometimes there are films with agendas, Doug, as you know. Hillary's America, the film 2 years ago, definitely a film with an agenda. Some of our more conservative listeners might say the Al Gore Inconvenient Truth films have an agenda. So I was careful to investigate this. What's going on here? Is this some kind of conservative film group, a hit job on Ted Kennedy after 9 years after he's died? But it really isn't. John Curran is actually a legit director. He's actually stated he's a fan of the Kennedys. So it's a fairly nuanced portrayal of the accident. But again, I wonder why the film had to be made. That's the real question here, and why it would be released at this time.
I had the same question when I saw it. Who's the audience for it?
I don't know. That's a great question, Doug. I don't think it's going to do very well at the box office. As to the nuts and bolts of the film, let's get into that. Jason Clarke, an Australian actor, plays Kennedy. There's been some mixed reviews on his performance. I thought he was quite good in the role. He plays Kennedy as sort of a wishy-washy man who does not know where he's going in his life. He's adrift after his brother's assassination. There's talk of him running for president in 72, but he seems not terribly convinced that he wants to be president. At this point, he has not become the full-fledged champion of the left that he became in the Senate, a real mover and a shaker in the Senate. He had not really achieved that yet. He'd only been in the Senate for 7 years. And I thought the performance was quite good. Kate Mara, Rooney Mara's sister, plays Mary Jo Kopechne. Now, one of the problems with the film, Doug, is I think they get to the accident too quickly. We're within 10 to 15 minutes, he's driving off that bridge in the dark of night.
That's a pretty short role for Kate Mara.
That's an extremely short role for Kate Mara, who's actually a known actress. I anticipated this to be more of an equal performance between Kopechne and Kennedy. That's not what we get. We do get flashbacks later on of Kate Mara as Kopechne, but really there's no character development whatsoever for Mary Jo Kopechne, her involvement with the Kennedys, her reluctance to go back into politics. You know, Ted's trying to convince her to maybe come and work for him in some scenes. So I thought that was a failing. Most of the film, Doug, is the Kennedy machine responding to the accident. Old Joe Kennedy, played by Bruce Dern, assembles the old Camelot crowd, Ted Sorensen, Bob McNamara. They swoop in to try to control the narrative. Where's Kopechne's body going? How can we play this? How can we craft this? What are we going to say to the press? Were you driving? Were you not driving? So there's a lot of back channel back dealings of how to control the narrative and make sure Ted has a political future.
Well, in this historical environment, there's been a lot of violence in the United States at that point as well. So this is just one story of actually many.
Yeah, and really at the time, it's during the moon landings, Doug. So it's not the top story in the country at this time, which may have actually helped Kennedy a little bit. Once the big papers, the big news outlets get wind of what's going on in Edgartown, which is the little town right near Chappaquiddick, then all heck breaks loose, of course. But the real story is them trying to control the narrative. Does Senator Kennedy come clean on what really happened? There's really nothing new here, though, in terms of facts. Was he drinking? Were there guardrails? There were not guardrails. Was he having an affair with Kopechne? These things are only hinted at, and we're not really sure to this day. I will say this. I thought the film was going to be worse than it was. It is a fairly nuanced, delicate, balanced portrayal. It's not a hit job on Ted Kennedy. It doesn't try to make things out to be more than they were. He made horrible mistakes that night, not reporting the accident. But overall, it was a fairly nuanced, delicate portrayal, and it was better than I thought it was going to be.
Well, it was – this circumstance was very highly covered once it got the attention of everybody. And there was a nuance to the story that I guess was maybe resolved, maybe not. I want to know how the movie deals with it. And that is Mary Jo Kopechne didn't die immediately in the crash, apparently.
No. There is a diver portrayed in the film who – claims she could have been alive for a half hour down there with an air bubble. Now, if that's the case, then had Kennedy reported it immediately instead of going, he went right to his advisors, Joe Gargan and Paul Markham. And they tried to dive down there and get her. You know, Kennedy claimed he tried to make several dives. It's extremely dark. It's extremely murky. I don't know. We don't know the truth of it. Had he reported it immediately, we'll never know. Could she have been saved? We don't know. That's the great question that haunted him for 40 more years. What's interesting, too, is Ed Helms plays Joe Gargan, who's a Kennedy cousin who worked for Ted Kennedy. His portrayal is interesting because he wants Kennedy to resign. He cannot believe what's going on. He can't believe that he didn't report this, that he goes back to his hotel room and takes a nap in the middle of the night. And you know, all this is on the public record. So that's an interesting dynamic of this is he's not quite on the full Kennedy damage control bandwagon. He thinks that Ted really screwed up and needs to resign. Of course, as we know, he did not resign. He was elected many, many more times. Doug, the best line in the whole film is when Ted finds Joe Gargan and Paul Markham, his advisors, and they notice that he's wet. And they're like, Teddy, what's going on? And Kennedy says, I'm not going to be president. That is a telling line. It's a fascinating how Clark reads the line or recites the line, and it kind of tells you everything you need to know about this situation. No matter what people think of Ted Kennedy, it's actually a film I think worth seeing. It's not terribly good. It's not terribly bad, but Jason Clark's very good in the role, and I was surprised how even-handed the film was. It doesn't necessarily make Kennedy out to be a villain. It does really shine a light into the mistakes he made that night, for sure. But I think Kopechne needed to have a bigger part. And again, where's the audience? I'm not sure where the audience is for this.
So
I went out of curiosity.
Okay, not a big thumbs up here.
Hey. You know, I'm in the middle on it. It was watchable. If you're a Kennedy fan, if you're into the Kennedys, I think it's worth seeing just to check it out.
Okay, here's an Oscar trivia question for you.
Okay.
Who won Best Supporting Actor at the 1968 Academy Awards?
So you mean the ceremony for 68 is probably what you're asking? George Kennedy, Cool Hand Luke?
That's okay. Correct. All right. There was my connection. No connection family-wise.
George Kennedy, right.
Just share the last
okay.
name.
All
okay.
Right.
We've been to the movies with Matt Olien.
Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
This is Dakota Datebook for April 13th. While the shape of North Dakota has been the same since 1889, its puzzle pieces have changed a bit. North Dakota had 53 counties at statehood. Some were organized and some still awaited proper county government, and there was a variety of names and shapes not on the map today, particularly out west. Among those were Beaufort and Flannery counties. They were created in 1883 after dividing Ouellette County in Dakota Territory's far northwest corner. Today, Divide and Williams counties cover that spot on the map. These changes raised some questions for early local officials, like Williams County State's Attorney Joseph DeNoyer, who asked for an Attorney General's opinion regarding railroad taxes that were due to Beaufort and Flannery counties that had since become Williams County. On this date in 1892, North Dakota Attorney General Clarence A.M. Spencer wrote to DeNoyer after thorough research that Williams County could collect the railroad taxes. After all, Beaufort and Flannery no longer existed. As Williams County comprises Old Flannery and Beaufort unorganized counties, he wrote, it is nothing more than right that it should receive the money due said old counties. Counties continued to evolve until 1907, when state law only allowed counties to be created from unorganized territory or the division of organized counties. Over the years, some counties were eliminated and later restored, like McKenzie, Dunn, and Bowman, partly for the lack of settlement. Some of the counties no longer on the map are Wynn, Howard, Alfred, Wallace, Garfield, Stevens, and Villard. One great example of gerrymandering in North Dakota is the gooseneck of Ward County to stop Kenmare from becoming a county seat. Sioux, Slope, and Grant counties were the last ones created or organized in North Dakota just over 100 years ago. For all the changes, there's the same number of counties today as there were at statehood in 1889, 53. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Jack Dura. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from the North Dakota Humanities Council.
When I come back to them, I may be fonder and prouder than ever of my little women.
Joe, Meg, Beth, and Amy, iconic names in American literature. They are the March Sisters of Concord, Massachusetts, created by Louisa May Alcott in her timeless novel, Little Women.
Four small children is a recipe for heartache, headache, and indigestion.
A new masterpiece BBC television production will premiere on Prairie Public in May, but you can get a sneak peek at special one-hour premiere screenings on Sunday, April 29th at 2 p.m. at the Prairie Public Studio in Fargo and at the North Dakota Heritage Center in Bismarck. The event is free and open to the public, but please do let us know you'll be attending by registering at prairiepublic.org.
Monday on Main Street, we'll share excerpts from the Good Government Discussion Series, a project of ThinkND supported by the State Humanities Council, the Northern Plains Ethics Institute, and the Bush Foundation. Historian and scholar Clay Jenkinson moderates a community discussion about good government, and a media panel discusses the findings of public forums from around the state. We hope you can join us for Main Street on Monday. We hope you'll check out Main Street Weekend this Sunday morning at 10 Central. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your